Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Oh, good morning, Mo.
Morning.
I don't know if this is your first cup or not, but it's mine.
I thought it was going to be late, actually. I was running out to get a cup. I had said I might be 5 minutes late, but I got through that line pretty quick. So yeah.
That's good. Well, we've got one of our traditional what's new in your journal, or what caught your eye in your journal type of issues today. So since you probably have spent all your energy going downhill on mountain bikes over the past several days.
I have. Well, it's actually no energy, it's gravity. You remember that, right?
Well, that's right. We went over that last time.
And I
don't see any abrasions on forearms or anything like that, but I love to see in your postings on LinkedIn that you do wear a helmet, and we need to protect the editor of OE.
That noggin needs to be protected. I hear you.
Yeah, but I just I ride the kind of bikes that don't fall over indoors. So these days I'm pretty safe.
Good.
Anyway, what's on your mind from OE?
Well, so I went back and digged into the archives. I went through every so often. I go back and I look at sort of the last few years and think of if things are relevant, because we're often looking to update some of our insights. So one insight popped up that I thought was a couple of years ago, but I think it's very, very relevant today. And this was trying to understand, you know, this new generation of young surgeons, young trainees, medical students coming into the field, young faculty even at some points. But it's this Generation Z. You know, we've talked a lot about Generation Y, the millennials, but we did a piece called The ABCs of Gen Z. And let me just give you a little bit of a background before jumping into some of why I think they're different, or why we believe they're different than the millennial group of individuals.
And what's the years of birth for Gen Z?
Right. So these are loosely people born between 1995 and 2010. So they'd be in their early 20s, you know, in the earlies, you know, like sort of the earlier side of it's in their early 20s. Okay. But these are unlike previous generations, Mark, in that they've lived completely and solely in a, you know, social media digital era. They don't know anything else. Whereas millennials may have transitioned into it, but this group has just been born into it. While internet and smartphones have allowed this group to learn, socialize, and make impact in novel ways, we're also seeing the associated costs with respect to mental health in this particular group more than any other group. And if you go around any university campus, you see the focus on mental health now more than ever. Mm-hmm. And also, though, which is interesting, this Generation Z group takes pride in creative problem solving and motivation to make social change. So in many ways, they're different from other groups in that they aren't as focused on making money as they are on making change. That in itself was quite an interesting group, because we focus so much, at least early on, and I think people often confuse the millennial generation with this Generation Z, but I think it's a very, very different group. Let me just give you another example of why they're different from millennials. Now, for those who are wondering if you're a millennial, if you're born between 1981 and 1995, that would put you in the Generation Y. And then, you know, I'd be sitting in the Generation X, between, you know, born between 1965 and 1980. And then before that is the baby boomer group. So there's, you know, there's these multiple groups that are all within the hospital system and within the education system. And quite frankly, our readership are those multiple generations. So Gen Z is technologically way more savvy and pragmatic, risk averse, and individualistic compared to millennials. In fact, they argue that Gen Z, this newer group or younger group of individuals, is more financially responsible, but actually they're much more concerned about the cost of education than millennials were. And finally, Gen Z wants to find their dream job, whereas millennials prefer stability. Huge implications for the way we think about, you know, and also the way I think about some of the individuals I get, you know, the chance to work with. I mean, it is very different depending on sort of how one might identify with respect to, you know, their motivations. But it's been very interesting. I'm wondering, from your perspective, you've interacted with countless number of individuals, students, trainees. Has this generation been different for you than unlike others?
It's kind of hard to be perfectly honest with you, Mo, to differentiate the Z's from the Y's in the day-to-day learning environment and in the practice environment. If I had to say a differentiating factor, it would seem to me to be way more environmentally conscious.
Yeah.
The younger group, the Z group, than the Y group. They're both way more environmentally conscious than what my kids call the geezer group, which includes me. others with more respect call it the baby boomers, but it gives one optimism, I think, with that concern that we may be able to actually do something to stem climate change based on their energy and interest in this. And I see it in the trainees, and I see it in my kids who are in the Y generation. But on the learner side, in the discussion groups and journal clubs, et cetera, I have to be honest, it's really hard for me to differentiate the Y's from the Z's.
You know what happens for me is that, you know, when I get a chance to interact with individuals one-to-one, you really get a chance to get a sense. When you ask them basically, like, you know, what are your aspirations? The one thing that is uniquely different now, than I think used to be, is that I think, like, I certainly grew up with the mindset is you pay your dues. And in other ways, you kind of, you know, there's a ladder and you appropriately do the appropriate steps to climb that ladder, should you wish to climb that ladder. Not everyone wants to climb these ladders, but let's just say that's the case. So you would spend a certain number of years doing one thing. And then once that would lead to another opportunity, that would lead to, there was a very stepwise approach. But I get asked all the time, I say, but why do we do that? That's antiquated. Like, why can't I just do what I want to do? And why can't I just start a $1 billion company? I mean, this is the aspirational side of things, right? Like, why can't I just do it? And I think what's happening is they're seeing somewhat a rebuking of the university system, which is saying the university system, okay, I see I pay lots of dues. I come out very, very in debt. And I'm not sure where that will lead me. Whereas our generation was, if you do not have a university education, you know, that's the first path, or, you know, college education, or get some sort of education, then apprenticeship. And after apprenticeship with the education, you move forward and you keep going and you find yourself appropriate mentors. It just seems different now in that we're seeing, at least maybe in the tech world, so many more, you know, people doing very well with ever. And, you know, the idea of a university is, you can do it. I'm not sure it'll, you know, there's only a very small number of parts of university training that will actually help you. At least that's a perception among some. And so we're seeing that happening a lot, and changes are happening, right? Especially now with COVID being passed. But for the most part, that period where if you were trying to get an education in the last 2 or 3 years, it's been tough, right? You've really not been, like, the whole purpose of a educational environment has been you connect with people and you get in. And I think in many ways, if you're not even getting that, there's been a lot of people. I mean, the number of people I've been around that have said, I'm taking a year off, right, is more than I can ever remember. And I don't know really the core source of that, but this is the generation now that is definitely thinking more carefully about what is my passion? What do I want to do? And if it's not my dream job, do I want to be handcuffed to it for the next 20 or 30 years? That's happening. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree completely. And I will say, in defense of the rather stodgy universities historically, particularly on the science side and medical school side, you know, most medical schools now have programs where they encourage students who want to take a year off, that they can do it and jump right back into line, or take that year off and pursue another degree, you know, a business degree or a management degree or a clinical research degree, and then jump back in. So I do think that, at least on the medical school side, with which I'm most familiar, we are trying to adapt to the broader interests of our younger colleagues.
And I think you're right. I think if we're going to be successful, and I imagine that when you look at hiring and working with this, you know, current generation of highly talented individuals, you've got to become way more flexible. I think we've learned to do that. For example, it would have been unheard of for you and me to say, can you imagine this one? Hey, listen, I'm going to be in Florida for 2 weeks. I'm still working. I'm going to work from there. And I have a bunch of my other friends from other roles, from other places, who are also working. But we're all just going to hang out and, you know, work in the day in our environments, all doing different jobs, but we're going to do it remotely. And then we're just going to be in Florida. So they're calling them work vacations. So there's not taking vacation time. So we say, you're taking vacation time? No. We're working. So that would never have happened, but that is happening. Like that is, I have been the recipient of a work vacation request probably 10 times in the last 24 months. So,
wow.
And honestly, it works. Like they work hard. Like it's like, so it's hard to, we have it in our head that how can you be out in sun and I'm sitting here and you're enjoying yourself, but they're working, right? So it's just reinventing the workplace. So creating opportunities, money isn't the issue. Like, so how many times have been in a situation when someone wants to leave or, and they say, okay, well, do you need more money? It's not about money. No, it's not about money. It's I feel I need to, the word I get heard a lot, I will grow in this opportunity.
Right.
I think. So it's a whole different, truly a different generation, Mark.
Yeah, and I think that's a real reason for optimism is that these younger physicians in particular have really returned to the motivation for what can I do to make this patient better? What can I do to make the process better so more patients benefit and not driven by the size of their income? And that's what we need to save the professionalism that we have in medicine and preserve our social contract so that we can continue to operate basically independent of government in a way, because we're in medicine, we're responsible for who it gets in and how we monitor one another and how we judge one another and how we credential, et cetera, et cetera. And that takes a definitive commitment to our social contract moving forward. So I think we're in good hands with the Y's and the Z's.
And I would say to you that, for all the program directors who might be listening or the residents who might be listening, really, really bring up these issues and try to find ways in which we can make orthopedics even more attractive for all the right reasons, where we can make this opportunity, where we can harness the creativity of this generation. If you're a department chair, how do you retain faculty? I think you retain faculty by creating environments that allow this generation and the generations before to do it. The hardest part is how do you get multiple generations all feeling, good about the environment they're in? Because if you're catering to one, you're probably not necessarily catering to the other. And I think we've got to come, there's got to be an element of how do we individualize our environments in a way that we make everyone feel that they're getting what they need.
Right. And of course, a diverse environment is the best way to do that because you got lots of discussion and
absolutely. And
need to encourage discussion. Well, that's a wonderful wonderful series of thoughts that you brought up with that OE publication. But I'm just, I'm going to go back to traditional orthopedics, if that's okay, Mo.
Oh, but absolutely.
I've chosen one from the May 18th issue here that is kind of right up your, in particular, bowling lane here. Mm. It's it comes from our colleagues in Australia, from their joint registry. And the title of this manuscript is Bipolar Hemiarthroplasty Does Not Result in a Higher Risk of Revision Compared with Total Hip Arthroplasty for Displaced Femoral Neck Fractures. An analysis of 36,118 procedures from the Australian National Joint Replacement Registry. And of course, this fits really well with what you found with the health trial. But just briefly, they did a very sophisticated analysis using all the appropriate methods, Cox proportional hazards and instrumental variable analysis, et cetera. And they compared the results beyond 3 months for revision of hemiarthroplasty versus total hips. Their conclusion is since it doesn't result in a higher revision rate, is that the dislocation observed following total hip arthroplasty may be offset by the higher risk of revision for acetabular erosion or pain following bipolar hemiarthroplasty, resulting in more equivalent revision risk. Now, if I recall the health trial results, there were no difference in the revisions at the two-year outcome, and the health-related quality of life and functional measures, there were no difference at the two-year outcomes.
Well, there's no meaningful difference for sure. Yes, correct.
Right. There was a lot of appropriate applause for that trial and how difficult it was and the results. But almost all of my arthroplasty colleagues, and I'm sure you experience the same thing, is just wait for the longer term results. You'll see the difference. Of course, a registry study is not the same as a randomized control trial because there are variables in the decision making of which to use for an individual patient that affect those longer term outcomes. But so what are the plans for the health trial as far as the longer term outcomes, Noel?
Well, so I mean, one of the things we did right off the bat, so can you remind me, and maybe I missed it, I'm sure you said it, but how far out do these outcomes go? So for example, when they, in the registry paper, are they saying, oh, it's clearly beyond 2 years, but do you know, is there a limit that they went out to? Did they go beyond 5 years or 10 years or? I mean, it's beyond 2 years, I'm guessing for sure.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. Well,
it's the lifetime of the patient in the registry.
Okay, got it. Okay, so it's multiple years. So,
It's age patients 50 to 79.
Yep.
And it's longer than 3 months is the okay. Anything longer than 3 months.
Got it. Okay. So, you know, the immediate challenge we knew we were going to face is the external validity of that trial and the generalizability beyond 2 years. Because the truth of the matter is, just as you had appropriately said, you know, there was an increased risk of early revision due to, you know, total hip replacement, you know, it was usually at the acetabular side. And there was a slowly incremental increasing number of revisions occurring from the bipolar side or from the hemiarthroplasty side due to acetabular erosion and all the other things that happen associated with, you know, the longer term use of, let's say, that was the perception. But you know, they were just going, like they were high and they were just kind of merging right at the 2 year point. So everyone said, well, if you just go to 3 or 4 years, there'd be a big difference. Well, we did a meta-analysis, if you recall, published in the journal right after that, to added health to others. And we went up to 5 year outcomes. And based on randomized trials, we didn't see a difference in 5 year outcomes. So at a minimum, this registry work is, you know, real world data, so to speak. You can put that in big quotes, but that would help us give that insight. And I must say, it was only a very few studies and an OE original we did thereafter that looked at beyond 5 years, maybe at one or two studies, that suggested in the longer term total hip arthroplasty might, suggest that it had, you know, better outcomes with respect to rates of revision. The challenge with that analysis was it's based on a very small number of patients, certainly not 36,000 patients. So.
Okay.
I think if anything, this data helps corroborate what we knew, which is in that first 5 year period, we feel very comfortable saying there's no difference. And in the longer term, I think it just adds one more cast of doubt as to that we need more longer term RCT data. Now, are we going to get longer term RCT data? I don't know. And you could argue that health, had we had the foresight to think about following patients, you know, 10 years, we certainly should have done that. The problem we had is the pragmatics of funding and running trials, just as we did with other trials we've run together. So, I mean, you know, that was a big missed opportunity for us. And now we're hoping that we'll see other groups, you know, take on this challenge. Because you're right, at the end of the day, we will not have answered the question 100% to the satisfaction of those who are absolute total joint arthroplasty proponents. And I also think, Mark, in many ways, the average results that we get do not always apply to the individual. And I think you and I would agree that at an individual level, the surgeon-patient relationship takes precedence and he or she work together towards, you know, an outcome and also a plan that makes sense for them, you know, basically patient-centered care. So this data we have just helps, in giving insights depending on that individual.
Yeah, it's just a great deal of reassurance for those that are more often choosing hemiarthroplasty, that it's not an unreasonable decision just based on longer term outcome. And it was beyond 3 months out to 19 years. I did find it.
Yeah. So that's, you know, clearly that gives us a lot more thought of pause that, you know, maybe the limited data in randomized trials beyond 5 years should be reevaluated given, you know, other large databases.
Right. It's a little bit frustrating and defeating that when I started my career, the femoral neck fracture was called the unsolved fracture. And when I end my career, it's going to be called the unsolved fracture.
Yep, you're right. You're right. I've used that slide in the past, right? It was like 1953, something, you know, it was presented as the unsolved fracture. And here we are. And the thing that it is, I mean, it's not just this, but if you look at so many other areas that were in proximal humerus, distal radius, you know, the truth is there's lots and lots of studies in these areas because they're really important. They're very common. But it seems as though we're not necessarily, we're making incremental you know, changes. And if you look at the history of change over time, okay, great, get it. But you can also argue that, you know, some of the non-operative approaches did pretty well too. And like arguing A versus B operative, I don't know if they are the right powerful questions. Maybe it's actually, you know, does operation work? Where does it work? And quite frankly, where in the absolute patient, you and I've talked about this tons, where outside of the operation in that patient's journey, can we also make important shifts, whether it's in their psychology, whether it's their perceptions, whether it's prepping for surgery, whether it's post-operative care, all that. That's where I think, you know, where we have to spend our time and energy. Yeah, someone loves some of the time. I don't know if you or I going to spend our time and energy, but someone's going to have to spend their time and energy. You and I can critique those papers. So I'd love to do that. A lot of fun.
Yeah, I think we have added some heft to the data on which surgeons make decisions. But for sure, there still needs to be additional work, even in the area of femoral neck fracture. We've contributed some, and hopefully encouraged others to take that next increment forward as we try to continue to improve our patient care outcomes.
And so you know who can do it? And Mark, you know who can do it? Our Generation Z.
That's right. The Zers.
That creative problem solving group. Yeah. It's on them. It's on this young generation to take that baton and just go with it.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, Mo. Well, I'm going to get into my second cup and we'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Have a great day.
Take care. You too. Take care.
Bye.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.